You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 19th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author Scott Anderson, author of The Quiet Americans, Four CIA Spies at the Dawn of the Cold War, The Tragedy, Three Acts. With unemployment numbers rising, Mitch McConnell shuts down stimulus chances. Joe Biden hopes the fever will break once Donald Trump has left the building. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's vote tally nearing 80 million votes. However, after a call from Donald Trump, those Michigan canvassers, they flipped again on certifying Detroit. And speaking of Donald Trump, he and his Republican administration admit to looking to light so many fires, Joe Biden won't be able to put them all out. And what do you do with a former Trump speechwriter who was fired for going to a conference with white nationalists? Well, of course, you appoint him to a commission which has primary responsibility for protecting Holocaust memorials in Europe. A wrongful death lawsuit filed against Tyson Foods alleges managers would bet on how many of its employees would catch COVID. Multiples did, and at least four died. Meanwhile, Mike Pompeo visits the Golan Heights, claims that exerting pressure on Israel over the occupied territories is anti-Semitic. And the COVID and recession silver lining, U.S. greenhouse gases at their lowest level in three decades. New report, White House blocked a DOJ deal to pay for the mental health services for separated families. And lastly, we now have hit over 250,000 deaths in this country from the coronavirus. 179,000 new infections, 1,923 deaths, and 80,000 hospitalized as of yesterday, as reports come in from around the country that hospitals are being overrun. And we are on the brink, of course, of Thanksgiving holidays. That means travel. That means people seeing each other in tight quarters. And we still have a major, I don't know what to call it, ideological, cultural divide over the, not even the efficacy, it's the attempts to curtail the virus. This seemed to be a very loaded question in terms of the, of COVID. And yesterday we had on the program one of the top epidemiologists in the country, someone who had worked with or has worked with Ebola in Sierra Leone, and one who works with infectious diseases and is a student of past epidemics. And he's never seen, I mean, there is no real precedent for the, and I don't want to say politicization, because of course everything is everything in some respects is political, and everything can and often should be politicized when it involves government policy. You weaponize certain things for political advantage, and hopefully you do so in a way that is has some fidelity to the truth. But the idea that an entire party would adopt as an ideological precept that masks don't protect you or other people in the context of a pandemic is just out and out nuts. It's insanity. I mean, the only other equivalent we can find, at least in modern times, is that same party, the Republican Party, denying the existence of global warming, or denying the existence that it's man-made, or then denying the ability for humans to in any way change the trajectory of global warming. I mean, I keep coming back to, when I hear these things, that we have a that at the heart of the coalition that has voted for Donald Trump are religious fundamentalists. And being a religious fundamentalist, being a fundamentalist of any sort, really, it impacts the way that you not just perceive reality, but the way that you ingest and digest information. And it also, I think it implicates the way that you perceive our ability and even the propriety of us attempting to deal with things like science, like natural sciences. Like, on some level, I'm not convinced that in its deepest recesses, the ability for someone like the governor of South Dakota to get up there and while her state is engulfed, both the Dakotas are engulfed in COVID, to get up there and say their masks, you know, there's no proof that masks help in any way, is just sort of a reluctance to say that humanity, I should say, or the people or that society has the ability to in any way affect biology is just an offense. I think that's a big part of it. It's just God gave us COVID. We just got to ride this thing out. That's not what they have said explicitly, but part of that has got to be the subtext. Here's a clip. This clip comes via a reporter at the Ohio Capital Journal, Tyler Buchanan. You can find him on Twitter at Tyler Joe LB, or it could be Tyler Joel B. And this is a Republican state representative, J. Todd Smith. I used to feel bad about playing clips of, like, you know, state senators or what's going to become of them. But of course, you know, so much of what we've seen over the past 20 years starts in state houses and then works its way up. But this is also indicative of the entire Republican Party as it stands right now. Here is a Republican state representative, J. Todd Smith, talking about, and I know this is very, here it is. He's talking about the, a bill that purports to deal with the coronavirus. And in Ohio, we should tell you, well, all right, go ahead, play this.
But also our public economy. COVID's had no effect on our economy. Our response as leaders in this state is what has had an effect on our economy. If the people are scared to go to restaurants, I put a lot of blame on the fear-mongering that was produced by experts who over-predicted what this was going to do early on. That is not to discard the idea that we want to listen to experts. That's what we're doing here. I disdain the idea, though, that if I'm not a doctor and epistemologist or whatever it is, that somehow I can't speak in an informed way to this bill or to this issue.
You know what? I think if you don't know what an epidemiologist is, I think maybe that should be disqualifying. I mean, obviously, you know, you've been elected, you get the right to do it. But I do think it should be disqualifying in the minds of people who want to actually have some form of reasoned debate about it. If you don't know that when you're talking about a pandemic, that epidemiology, not epistemology, is more relevant, then yeah, I would actually question that. And I would also say that the idea that people are afraid to go to restaurants because of state or federal or local or medical officials have scaremongered is just, it's bat crap crazy. In Ohio, put up the Ohio map. The number of cases over the past 14 days has grown by 107%. The number of hospitalized has grown by 88%. The number of deaths have grown by 19%. Now, hospitalizations and deaths, they're lagging indicators. So this 14-day change, one can imagine that in 3 to 4 weeks, we're going to see that number of deaths increase dramatically. I mean, it's nuts. And there's a drop there, and I think that drop is probably, now I can't quite tell, on November 18th. It's possible that some of that scaremongering worked. You got to wait a couple of days to see. Dropped, you know, down to where it was last week.
Yeah, it looks like the peaks in both Ohio and also the Dakotas was earlier this week. But I mean, who knows if that's going to remain that way?
Well, let's hope, which means that the scaremongering is working, because that means that people are actually saying, like, hey, maybe I shouldn't go to that restaurant. If you're looking for why the economy is suffering and why Ohioans or any other people around the country are suffering from the economic implications of people not wanting to go to work and risk getting sick, or not wanting to go and eat at a restaurant because they don't want to risk getting sick or dying, or the implications of people not going to a bar or going to a gym, you should look to Washington, D.C., where there was a massive failure by the Republicans to pass any type of economic relief. And now we're not going to see any until early February at the earliest, it seems. Yeah. And we're having 12 million people are going to run out of unemployment the day after Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody. And we're going to see eviction moratoriums end within days after that. And we're going to be in many parts of the country in a position where you're going to see hospitals, and you can build more beds. I mean, you can stick beds in a gym, but if you don't have enough nurses and you don't have enough doctors, it's not going to make a difference to treat people who are getting very ill. And then, of course, you know, we won't know for a while the long-term implications of getting COVID. I mean, we're starting to get an idea of it, but we don't know how widespread it will be. It really is stunning. And then this guy, whatever it is.
Yeah, we should just say epistemology is the study of knowledge, and like, what is knowledge and how do you attain it? And like, we probably could have an army of epistemiologists, I can't say it now, on the GOP's case to figure out what the hell's going on there too as well.
Epistemologists. Yes, all going in and dealing with the epistemological closure that guy is has been subjected to, apparently. But it's a scary time. It's just it's a bizarre and scary time. With that said, we're going to change things up a little bit and maybe take a little story of how the CIA and our entire perspective on the Cold War could have gone right, but went horribly, horribly wrong with Scott Anderson. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the, we have him on Zoom, returning to the program, Scott Anderson. He is a journalist, novelist, a veteran, a war correspondent, and was last on this program for Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Scott, good to see you again. I think you were on, it feels like it was about like 45 years ago.
It was a while.
it's been a while, but it's great to have you here and back with another really fascinating book. And I mean, I guess I don't know if I had forgotten that you were a war correspondent, and the for me personally, it's fascinating because I think when the movie Salvador came out, I was just beginning to understand our role as a country in Central America. I think I was in college somewhere around that time, and was learning about it. And that's more or less where you got your start, or at least it was the genesis in some respects of this book.
Right.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I was in El Salvador. I was kind of an aspiring, a failed journalist at this point in my career. It was in 1984. The dirty war in El Salvador had been going on for 4 years at that point, in which the Reagan administration was supporing the right-wing government. The government of El Salvador was running death squads that had killed some 40,000 purported communists, mostly just people on the left side of the spectrum. But by 1984, the dirty war was largely coming to an end. The death squad numbers were way down. And at this point, the Reagan administration, in order to continue funding the Salvadoran government, had to get certification every year from Congress that human rights were improving. So there is this ongoing fiction that somehow the death squads and the government were two completely separate entities. I happened to be in Salvador, and it was for the inauguration of the new president in Salvador, and I was walking down a street in downtown San Salvador, the capital, when a van passed me, pulled to the curb, maybe 100, 150 feet in front of me, and the body of a woman was thrown out onto the sidewalk. Classic death squad victim. Her hands were tied in front of her. She'd been shot in the head. And I happened to be the only person close by. And as I was walking towards this dead woman, a military van pulled up alongside the body. And this is all in the space of at most 10 seconds. Three soldiers jump out. They throw her body into the military van and drive away. So it was this kind of very obvious sleight of hand that had honed by long practice, but it allowed the government to maintain this fiction that somehow the death squads and the army were were separate things. And that experience, almost more than anything else I can think of, really kind of clarified this message in my mind, question in my mind of how has it come to this? How, in the name of fighting communism, or what some people claim is communism, has the United States gotten into bed with death squad regimes around the world? And then in looking into the past of overthrowing democratic regimes, plotting assassinations around the world. So that was kind of the genesis where I thought I really wanted to try to understand how this happened. How did America go from being this kind of shining city on the hill at the end of World War II? We were going to be the exporter of democracy around the world. We were going to dismantle the colonial empires around the world. And then in a very few years, in fact, we're overthrowing democratic governments and propping up the colonial empires.
Well, certainly the and your book follows that that period from 44 to 56, which is essentially the birth of the CIA.
Right.
And you track it with four, I guess, sort of four different men who represent sort of, I guess, different positions within the start of the CIA, if you will. But let's just talk, how much of the country was, how much of it was that the country's perspective was that, you know, trying to export democracy and sort of model good behavior versus that was the perspective of some of these guys? Like, I mean, you know, we certainly were colonial in at least narrow circumstances around, at least in our hemisphere, right? Up until that point, I mean, the Philippines and, the West and, Cuba. I mean, we certainly had designs on things, but, maybe they weren't so, I guess, far reaching. I mean, just clarify that for me as we set this up.
We may be one of the only empires in history that steadfastly refuses to recognize we're an empire, the United States. Yes, certainly, as you say, prior to World War II, we saw Latin America as our backyard, and going all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine, kept other powers out. We had colonized the Philippines and Cuba, but it was really with World War II that for the first time the United States was on a truly global stage and a global superpower. We had been allied with the Soviet Union in defeating the Axis. And I think that there was an idea, certainly within the early Truman administration, that alliance, that wartime alliance with the Soviets, would continue. The Soviets clearly had a very different plan in mind. Very quickly, essentially annexed all of Eastern Europe and were fomenting communist revolutions around the world. So I think America was kind of slow to the mark in realizing that we are now in a new conflict. And so it wasn't until 1947 that the CIA was created, and then the following year that this covert action wing of the CIA, the Office of Policy Coordination, was created. And most of the men I write about are from that, the Office of Policy Coordination, and involved in covert operations around the world.
One of the things that really struck me, and I guess I just never really had thought about it, was how outgunned we were in that, like in the spy business. I was trying to, I was thinking like as to why that might be the case. I mean, presumably, right? It's like, cause you have all these countries in Europe over the course of the first half of the 20th century in particular, who, what's happening in the neighboring country can very easily have direct implications for what's happening in yours. And right, any advantage you can get in terms of affecting the outcome of what happens in another country, or at least advance warning that, like, hey, wait a second, guys, we might want to put some horses on our northern border, because things are looking a little weird up there.
Right.
I mean, is that why we were so, because it, and even as you talk about the, even as you write about those first, like, I guess 12 years or so, it feels like to the extent that there were successes And, you know, I think your whole book in many respects is like, even the successes were ultimately failures. But to the extent that there were any successes, it seems to not be in Europe. Like we were JV. It feels like on some level.
Oh, we were such JV. A great way to illustrate that is, one of the men I write about, Peter Sichel, he's actually still alive. He's 98 years old. He became the first, it wasn't called the CIA yet, but it was the precursor of the CIA, but essentially the first station chief of the covert operation unit of the American military in Berlin immediately after World War II. Already by the fall of 1945, Berlin was becoming the ground zero of the coming Cold War. And the Soviets had certainly thousands, if not tens of thousands, of intelligence operatives in Berlin at the time. Peter Sichel is put in charge of a unit that consists of nine men, and he's just turned 23. So it really just illustrates just how completely clueless the Americans were. I'm not taking anything away from Peter Sichel's brilliance, but absolutely JV. And you know, America is constantly oscillates between flexing its muscle around the world and going into isolation. And clearly at the end of World War II, we had planned to go into another isolationist period. The American military was demobilizing at the rate of 10,000 soldiers a day. And Roosevelt had famously told Stalin that in 1 year's time, he didn't anticipate there being any American soldiers left in Europe. And of course, Stalin's eyes just lit up at that, because in his mind, that was just unilateral disarmament.
All right. Well, let's talk about the four people. You've already mentioned Sichel, I guess is the pronunciation. Yeah. Let's start, I guess, with Frank Wisner, who was the first chief of the covert operations, essentially, of the CIA. Give us his background and how did he become that guy?
Yes, Frank Wisner was he had actually been a Wall Street lawyer before World War II, he anticipated the war coming. He anticipated America joining World War II, so he quit his law firm and joined the Navy. During the war, he ended up in the Wartime Intelligence Agency of the United States, the Office of Strategic Services, and in that role, he was actually probably the first American serviceman to watch the Red Army, the Soviet Red Army, in action. He was in Romania in the summer of 1944 when Romania switched sides in the war. They had been allied with Nazi Germany. They switched sides. The Red Army flowed in, and Wisner watched as the Red Army essentially took over the country in a matter of days. And from that, his experience of that time, he was the canary in the coal mine, and he was sending messages back to Washington saying, you know, this wartime alliance is going to end. The Soviets are not our allies. He ends up not
that was
being
a function of that was I should just say that he, there was a function of him watching them take ethnic Germans and put them in trains,
putting them in boxcars and sending them off as slave labor inside the Soviet Union.
Which, of course, if you have just come out of liberating, I mean, you know, I don't know where if Wisner was, you know, part of necessarily of liberating any camps, but I would imagine that was the talk. Sure. If you were stationed in Germany, right, and watching that happen again, you know,
that's exactly right. Yeah, no, it had a profound effect on him. And you know, he really became a ardent cold warrior from that moment. He wasn't listened to at the time. He goes back to his Wall Street law firm immediately after the war. When the Office of Policy Coordination was started up in 1948, the covert action wing of the CIA, he's named the head of it. And so over the next decade, he creates what's called the Mighty Wurlitzer, this vast apparatus that was operating in some 60 countries around the world, all designed to fight the communist threat. And it was everything from very soft power initiatives, like they set up overseas library programs throughout Europe of giving people access to American literature, brought Broadway troops over to Europe, started the Paris Review. So this is all kind of on the soft power side, and then on over to the hard power of overthrowing governments, assassinating foreign leaders, airdropping anti-communist partisans behind the Iron Curtain. So it ran this whole gamut of activities.
How much, I mean, when I hear, you know, Wall Street guy becoming an ardent anti-communist, right, that, you know, I immediately, because from my perspective, my retrospective, I guess, you know, view of our involvement around the world, I immediately think like, oh, he's doing this for corporate interests, for financial interests. How much of it was that? Was it ideological at that time, or was it like I watched them march people into boxcars?
Right. I think it was ideological. The interesting thing about all four of the men I profile, all of them were quite liberal, politically liberal, certainly socially very liberal. They really did see, in many ways, the communist threat, you know, especially under Stalin. I mean, the Stalin regime was an absolutely brutal, brutal regime. They really saw it as kind of a carry on from the, you know, the war against the fascists of Japan and Germany. So I think, and Peter Sichel, the man still alive, he described it as a crusade. He said this was a romantic crusade. We were the good guys. They were the bad guys. We were going to save the world. So I think initially there was a huge amount of idealism involved in it, and that gradually was compromised in the sorts of operations they got involved with.
Yeah, let's talk about Edward Lansdale. Was he the quiet American? I mean, was he the model for Graham Greene?
Graham Greene insisted he wasn't, but they knew each other in Saigon in the mid 1950s and despised each other. And I think that Graham Greene just didn't want Lansdale to have the satisfaction of thinking that, you know, a book had been written about him. Lansdale had been a ad man in San Francisco, worked on the Levi Strauss contract. He became known as the miracle worker of Asia. He went out to the Philippines immediately after World War II. The Philippines, essentially an American colony ruled by a really corrupt oligarchy. And there was now the beginnings of a communist insurgency in the Philippines. And Lansdale had this very simple kind of Madison Avenue idea that if you want to win over the local people, if you want to turn back the communist threat, you have to give the people a government they can believe in and that works for them. So he found a kind of obscure Filipino senator and made him the Minister of Defense. The military, which had been actually very much like the Salvadoran military in the 1980s, essentially a death squad military. He and Raymond Magsaysay reformed the military. They had soldiers going out doing refurbishing schools and clinics and even bringing in harvest from the fields, and made the army essentially the people's army, and succeeded in defeating the communist insurgency in the Philippines in about a 2-year period. It's one of the very few success stories. On the basis of that, the CIA, Lansdale's back in Washington in 1954. The CIA director says, you know, we have problems in another Asian country, Vietnam. We want you to go there and just do the same thing in Vietnam that you did in the Philippines. And so Lansdale goes off to Vietnam and very nearly succeeds. He cozies up to the Vietnamese prime minister. He launches all these reform programs. Lansdale was the head of the first American military mission to Vietnam, and it consisted of him and 12 other men, you know, ultimately to be followed by nearly 3 million more.
Wow. And then tell us about Michael Burke.
Yeah, Michael Burke is just a fabulous character. I describe him in the book as James Bond before James Bond existed. Burke had been a commando with the OSS during World War II, dropped behind enemy lines, extraordinarily handsome. People describe him as the most charming man they ever met. In 1949, he's tried his hand at writing screenplays out in Hollywood. That's gone belly up. He's living in New York, trying to be a writer. So, you know, as a result, impoverished. the CIA, the Office of Policy Coordination, come to him and go.
How do they come to him? I mean, how does that how does that happen? Like, oh, we're just going to go roll for
because of because all these men came out of the OSS during World War II, okay. So it was kind of that OSS fraternity, and so there was this kind of Burke sat with these two men from the CIA at the Algonquin Hotel in New York. And they kind of beat around the bush for a while. And they finally said to Michael Burke, so what do you know about Albania? And Burke didn't know anything about Albania, except that it was a communist regime in Eastern Europe. And they finally get around and say, we want you to start a revolution in Albania. And to do that, we're going to pay you $10,000 a year. You're going to have to move to Rome. You're going to have to live large in Rome because your cover story is going to be as a film producer. So Burke basically says, you know, where do I sign? And he goes off to Rome and lives this really is very cinematic, this kind of crazy double life where as a film producer, he's hanging out with all these Italian directors and stars in Rome. And he's periodically slipping away to meet up with these Albanian conspirators.
And this is in the late '40s, right?
Late '40s, right.
And we should say this is almost like the pilot program.
That's right. Albania was the pilot program. Yeah. Okay. And the code name for it was Operation Valuable Fiend, which I also got very lucky with the operational names in this book because some of them are pretty boring. I got some pretty good ones. So
Valuable Fiend.
Valuable Fiend. Yeah, that was the operation.
And I should say that in the book, the story of how he was worried that, you know, he would be quite like, what are you doing? Like, you know, what things have you produced? I think showed a real ignorance of Hollywood where nobody really, as long as you're paying for the drinks, everybody assumes you're doing something. Nobody believes what anybody's doing anyways.
That's right. And what he discovered when he was worried that he was worried that they were going to start asking questions of, you know, what he was actually doing there, but he discovered there. The Italian film people were just as self-absorbed as the ones in Hollywood. All they wanted to do was talk about themselves. So never ask them a question. So.
Film producers don't do anything anyways.
Exactly. That was just, yeah, that's right. But,
right. So, and then that didn't work.
It didn't work. It was a disaster. And Burke then went on from Albania to head to Germany and heading covert operations there, these infiltration operations throughout Eastern Europe and Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, and they were all disasters. The Soviets had these groups infiltrated from the get-go.
There was tell about the Polish hoax, because I mean the thing that's amazing about this is that, you know, we call it the pilot program, but you know, there was no proof of concept.
That's right.
Like it never ever worked. They were it seems they were completely mismatched, overmatched. And at one point, you have this, and in fact, in an end, so I mean, just jumping ahead, I guess, and to the Hungarian Revolution, which is reminiscent in my mind of like of George Herbert Walker Bush's sort of encouragement for the Kurds,
right?
And then when they finally respond, nothing. Yeah, I mean, it's like they spend all this time trying to foment revolutions. And by doing that, why don't you talk about that dynamic? That the attempts to foment revolutions actually ended up inhibiting their ability to support the one that happened organically.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it was this idea, and this was Frank Wisner. You know, his dream was to try to foment an anti-communist uprising somewhere in the Soviet bloc. It finally happened with Hungary in 1956. See, I never saw it coming. There was no way to see it coming. It was a truly spontaneous, organic uprising. And in a 24-hour period went from students demonstrating in the streets to full-scale insurrection where Red Army soldiers were being hunted down and killed in the streets of Budapest. Wisner happened to be in Europe at the time that this was going on, and he was sending cables, frantic cables, back to the Eisenhower administration saying, look, we finally got what we've been urging these people to do for the past 10 years. We have to come to their aid. All of a sudden, the Eisenhower administration thinks, uh-oh, you know, if we go into Hungary, if we go into the Soviets' backyard, it might trigger a war that could end up being a nuclear war. So they just washed their hands of the whole affair. The Soviets crushed the revolution, and Wisner happens to be on the Austrian border with Hungary as these 200,000 Hungarian refugees stream across the border, as the Soviets are hunting them in the background. And he has a complete nervous breakdown that he never actually really recovers from, and he ends up committing suicide a number of years later.
It was the plan all the time. I mean, like, you know, I guess maybe I'm just sort of, you know, today there was a story about how the Trump administration, they conceded that what they're trying to do is set so many fires that Biden, when he gets into office, can't deal with them.
Right.
I mean, there doesn't seem to have been any actual, like, even if there's this one story, and we don't really have too much time for it, but where they thought they had, you know, some partisans, I guess, in Poland, and they kept sending them guns and money. And it turns out it was just like a sting operation. And just like the counterintelligence people are just taking all the money and all the weapons.
Yeah.
But was this really just about like, we can't really succeed at any of these things that we're talking about, but what we can do is just like provide, you know, some headache for somebody in the interior that they have to deal with?
You know, it's a great question. I think what happened, one thing that I was really stunned by, it came as a real revelation to me, is that the Americans in general, and the CIA in particular, had nobody inside the Stalin regime. I mean, not a mole, you know, a junior officer in the Kremlin, nobody anywhere. So they were operating completely in the dark. So really the only way in hopes of trying to figure out what was happening behind the Iron Curtain in their mind was to do these infiltration operations in the hopes that one or two of these 50 people they were sending in might survive and be able to come back and tell them something. But it really was kind of shocking how in the dark they were. And so someone in their defense, I think that, and when you're dealing with a kind of a crazy figure like Stalin, you can understand this sort of sense of panic. They never saw the Korean War coming. That, you know, the Russians got the nuclear weapons 3 years before they were supposed to. So they're over and over again, there was these shocks to the system that I think really kind of put them in a defensive crouch.
Wasn't there also this sort of, there was an attempt at one point by Khrushchev early on to sort of, and I can't find it here in my, the Peaceful Coexistence Initiative, I guess, that Kennan, who was then the Secretary of State, I guess, basically rejected. Like there was another road not taken that would have aligned more with the American capacities, it seems, to do whatever they thought they were going to do, which was to sort of like, if we can't beat them, which we can't, I mean, they had proof over and over again, not to mention, Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz, which seemed to me sort of like, you know, an example of like, well, here's a smaller pond that we can play in and we can be better at. And was ostensibly about Russian expansion, but I think may have also, in my mind, been about people using the idea of, well, I guess, Soviet expansion at that time as a cover for corporate interests more than, wow. You know, like all of a sudden this idea, like it's one thing to be in the middle of Eastern Europe and say, hey, these guys are expansionist. It's another to be, you know, down in Guatemala and going like, we got to get in there because Russia's going to move in.
Right.
That seems to me more about like, I'm really worried about our banana plantations down there or something.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Certainly by the time the Eisenhower administration's coming in, there was this vast, commercial world that fueled and depended on the ongoing Cold War. And, you know, it was famously Eisenhower himself was the one who coined the phrase, the military industrial complex. I think what you mentioned of this kind of overture that the Eisenhower administration missed, I think one of the great sort of crossroads of history was the fact that Stalin died just 6 weeks after the Eisenhower administration came in. And as you said, his successors, they were vying for power. They sent out this message, never been done before, that they want to have peaceful coexistence with the West. Eisenhower's tempted to extend an olive branch back. He's persuaded by his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, who was the ultimate Cold Warrior, to reject it. He said, this is a sign of Soviet weakness. You know, why should we accept a half a loaf of bread when we're about to get the whole thing? So again and again in that mid-1950s period, when there were these overtures from the Soviets towards peaceful coexistence, culminating in the Hungarian Revolution, the Americans just consistently rejected them. And there's this really kind of eerie parallel between what Khrushchev was trying to do in the mid-50s and what Gorbachev did 30-some-odd years later. And it's not far-fetched to think that you might have been able to end the Cold War right then in the mid-1950s. And as I said, it went on until 1989.
That possibility is fascinating to contemplate, what the trajectory of the whole world would have been if the Soviet Union was part of NATO, I guess.
Right, which Khrushchev asked to become part of NATO. And yeah, and if it had happened then you wouldn't have had Vietnam, you wouldn't have had Salvador, you wouldn't have had Chile, you wouldn't have had hundreds of things going on around the world, tragedies ever since.
And lastly, I mean, just why did it take you so long to get to this book? If you had that awareness of that something had gone awry with the U.S. covert operations and the CIA that ended up, you know, dumping that woman in front of you, essentially.
Right.
How did you come to do this book now?
Good question. You know, I mean, the short answer is I had to pay the bill. So I was doing a lot of journalism. Just prior to this, I did this special project for the New York Times Magazine where I thought it was going to be, writers are always deluded optimists. And I did this project that I thought was going to take me 6 months of doing this survey of the Arab Spring revolutions, and it taking 2 years of my life. I can't really give a good answer why it took me so long to get, but I promise you my next one won't take 6-7 years.
Well, no, it wasn't tied to me, but it was more like how did it take you to get to this topic as opposed to going through because this really does ask that question of of the roads not taken, right, and the disillusionment that these guys suffered when they realized oh wow, we've been doing we did worse than not success. We did damage.
Right. You know, I think it always occurred to me that I wanted to look at that period because it really was the seminal period of the Cold War, those early years, and I was drawn to it. The kind of history I like to write is where you have, I mean, not necessarily ordinary people, quote, but. People who have a tremendous amount of freedom of action. And that was true in the early Cold War, the early CIA. These guys were sent out in the field and kind of left to their own devices. They could try this operation or not. So it's really that period. I mean, this is kind of more from a writer's standpoint. It's that period when everything isn't being decided by guys sitting behind desks. And, it's really guys out in the field living by their wits. And I'm fascinated by that over and over again in my writing.
Scott Anderson, the book is The Quiet Americans, 4 CIA Spies at the Dawn of the Cold War, A Tragedy in 3 Acts. It is, we're living, I think, in many respects with still on that trajectory, though obviously it's changed a little bit, but it is fascinating to contemplate, which I think these guys must have contemplated, what if we had taken that other road? But we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam. My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And check that book out. I mean, it is just fascinating to contemplate what if we had gone in that different direction. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, folks. You know, one of the things that we're going to be watching over the next couple of days and, you know, a week or two is assuming that Joe Biden is allowed to assume the role of president-elect. I mean, he has, but in such a way that actually he can start to do stuff for the American public, right? Like, I don't know, roll out a plan on how we're going to deal with the raging COVID infections across the country, or begin to prepare all of the executive actions. Now, we now have an increase in initial claims for jobless benefits. This is a way in which people essentially, statisticians, measure layoffs. It rose to 742,000 people last week. That was up from 711,000 filed a week earlier. I mentioned at the top of the show, we have 12 million people who are going to be off of extended unemployment benefits on December 26th. And if we're adding to the ranks of the unemployed, we are looking at moratorium eviction moratoriums ending across the country. We're looking at an economic disaster for people. We showed that clip yesterday. The cars lining up for food in Dallas, I think it was. I mean, miles, it seemed like, of cars lining up for food. And we have Mitch McConnell has just left the building, is my understanding. There does not seem to be any appearance of an attempt to deal with any type of stimulus package, at least before their Christmas break. And what just continues to gall me, on a day after Nancy Pelosi was nominated to become the Speaker of the House again by the Democratic caucus, is the utter failure of Pelosi and Schumer to either predict or that this was happening. I mean, because this is not a scenario that should be of any surprise to anybody. I mean, we talked about this, that if Joe Biden wins the election and Nancy Pelosi doesn't even take that $1.8 trillion, who knows if it was even real, but doesn't even sign off to take it, there wasn't going to be any help for the American public until at least January 22nd, at best. And now, unless the Democrats take these seats in Georgia, who knows what Joe Biden's going to get from Mitch McConnell? He seems to be thinking that he's going to be able to get something. But this was predictable. And the idea that Mitch McConnell will pay no price for this, because he will not. You cannot take advantage of these type of political moments if you decide to take advantage of them 15 minutes before they happen. The value of Nancy Pelosi saying yes to Steve Mnuchin's $1.8 trillion offer, regardless of what was in it, was because it was going to force Mitch McConnell to either vote for it or against it. And if they voted for it, it would have been strife amongst Republican senators in the Republican caucus. And if they voted against it, Mitch McConnell's actions today would look that much more worse. And they're going to look that much more worse in 2 weeks and in a month and in 3 months. But the predicate has not been set. And the Republicans have gotten away for 4.5 years without having to pay any price for their relationship with Donald Trump. The only time they did is when people didn't have the opportunity to vote against Donald Trump, and so they voted against Republicans as a second-order measure. But when Trump was on the ballot, folks didn't have that that need. All right, we're going to say goodbye. We'll be back tomorrow. For those of you sticking around, we're going to go into the fun half. The crew is going to be taking over the gang. Old Matt, new Matt, new Emma, I guess new Jamie. I mean, if Matt's new, Emma and Jamie just they're timeless, I guess. But they will be here. Are they going to sign on in just a moment? I just want to remind you, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the fun half, and then you support the free half, and then you get the fun half right after that. So check it out. Join the majoritypoint.com. Don't forget also AM Quickie, 7 minutes of headline news from a left perspective. Some stories you don't hear generally when you hear headline news. In fact, a decent amount of them that you don't. And we get it out the door very early. Today we had a little bit of a technical hiccup, so we didn't get it out until like a 9 or so, but in general, we get it out very quickly. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Don't forget, we also have merch. It's getting around Hanukkah and Christmas, folks. And are we at the winter solstice, or has that already happened?
No, that's about a month away.
Pretty sure that's in December.
There's a lot of gifts. There's a lot of gift-giving opportunities, and Majority Report swag makes a great gift. shop.majorityreportradio.com. All right, well, everybody has aligned. Don't forget, today on Noam Keyes' show, check it out, 3 p.m., youtube.com/TheNoamKeyesShow. And on that show today, you will see Kevin Young, the author of Levers of Power, How the 1% Rules About and What the 99% Can Do About It. Representative Chris Robb and Arun Chaudhary will be on there today, 3 p.m. noon on YouTube, right after today's Majority Report. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we have kind of a sit around and chat episode. You know, some of our episodes are more formal interviews. This time, just me and Sean sitting and chatting. We talked a little bit about my experience canvassing for the Defund NYPD campaign. I opened up about how I'm feeling discouraged and depressed and how that is a normal thing to feel when you are a leftist. We talked about some bad takes on class and how we really wish people would understand class in the Marxist sense and why it is correct to do so. And did a little musing about the impact it will or won't have on millennials' politics, that some of their parents are boomers with property that they might inherit. Then again, they might not. There are a lot of factors there. I thought it was a pretty good one. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
And old Matt, what's happening on Doomed?
I wish I had the problem of inheriting property at some point. YouTube.com/
hey,
Matt Bin.
Hey, buddy. See that right behind me?
Well, yeah, Myla and Saul will have it all.
If you want, we'll see. We'll see what happens if you come by at the holidays.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe not this year.
Haven't gotten any calls from your kids lately. I just wanted to let you know that, but go ahead.
YouTube.com/Matt Binder. Tonight at 9 p.m., I will be going through all the conspiracy theories about the Dominion voting systems, especially in light of Trump sharing the OANN segment that featured a expert analyst who gave all this information about why there was electoral fraud. And that expert analyst just happens to be the son of the guy who owns 8kun, formerly known as 8chan. So, lots of fun stuff going on in the conspiracy theory world on the right. And we'll be going through it all tonight, youtube.com/Matt Binder, 9 p.m. Eastern time.
All right. And new Matt, what happened on TMBS this week?
Yeah, on TMBS this week, David Griscom talked to Paul O'Connell about UK labor. Paul O'Connell's really smart about the labor problem and how, you know, it's good that Corbyn's reinstated, but it's also sort of like being grateful for being kicked in the head. And so he talks about the future of the left and labor there. Also, next Tuesday, David Griscom and I will have a announcement at the normal TMBS time on Tuesday, 7 p.m. So look forward to that announcement, folks.
Shoot. There we go. All right. All right, Jamie, Matt, Emma, have fun. See you guys tomorrow.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.